Now, in Zechariah chapter 3, which we're looking at this evening, we find ourselves in the middle of a series of 8 visions that Zechariah had all of one evening. They're not dreams. They're not the product of Zechariah's imagination. They're not because he had too much rice pudding for supper the night before, whatever it was. Rather, they are visions that God uses to address his people and us through the prophet Zechariah. And what we're going to see in chapter 3 is that we see both that it is possible to return to God, that it's possible for each one to return to God, and also we'll see that we must return to God because God commands us to return to him. And I think as we look at it, we're going to find what Zechariah has to say to us both sobering and very liberating. I found it both of those things over the last week or so as I've been preparing, both sobering and liberating, and I trust that all of us this evening as we look at it will find that to be the case. Now you'll find an outline of where we're going on the back of the news sheet. There's a timeline and something on the structure of the book, but don't worry too much about those two things. You'll see on the second part of the outline where we're going to be going. And the first thing is that we all stand guilty before God. We all stand guilty before God. I guess it's fair to say, isn't it, that sometimes it is far better to know the truth than not know the truth, even when the truth makes us uncomfortable. I was reading an article by James Hughes Onslow in the Evening Standard a few months ago, and he was complaining about the standard of school reports. And he was explaining he has 2 children. One of them goes to a state school, one of them goes to a private school. And he is explaining how very different the end-of-term reports were, which he got from the 2 schools. And apparently the private school, he was saying, tend not to pull their punches. One line, for example, read, "This is the most uncommunicative child I have ever tried to teach." Perhaps memories of being called into your father's living room come back at the very thought of school reports. By contrast, he said that the state school reports are a pleasure to read. He writes, "We were delighted to read that our daughter was doing well, that she had good and positive friendships and a lovely sense of humour." But he says this wonderful picture fell apart when we discovered that virtually the same thing had been written about most of her friends. How does the article conclude? "Better to have no report at all than to have one that is misleadingly rosy." Now, I take it that there could be nothing more important than knowing exactly where we stand with God, far more important than school reports. And that actually, in our heart of hearts, we would much rather know where we do stand with God rather than being flattered. Which is why this courtroom drama in Zechariah chapter 3 is so important. Court cases always capture the popular imagination, don't they? Whether it's Charles Ingram defrauding Who Wants to Be a Millionaire with those surreptitious coughs of his friend in crime, or whether it's Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones wrangling over the wedding photographs. But here in Zechariah is the most dramatic court scene imaginable. So dramatic, I just want to read the first 3 verses again. See if you can spot the main players in the court scene as I do so. "Then he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. And the Lord said to Satan, 'The Lord rebuke you, O Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is this not a brand plucked from the fire?' Now Joshua, standing before the angel, clothed with filthy garments." Now there's no jury in this courtroom, but there's a judge, there's a prosecutor, and there is the accused. Now, the judge is God, verse 1, the angel of the Lord, the representative of God himself. As for the prosecutor, verse 2, he is Satan, the one who stands ready to accuse the prisoner in the dock. And the Bible's clear that Satan and God, that they stand in opposition to one another in the world. God clearly the more powerful. And occasionally in the Bible, the kind of curtain that stands across, that hidden opposition between God and Satan is turned aside, and we see the reality, as indeed we do in this chapter. And then there's the accused, Joshua, the high priest. And the irony is that as the high priest, Joshua is the spiritual leader of God's people, yet he is clearly unfit to lead God's people. Now, he alone had the awesome privilege of coming before God on behalf of the people so that they would be acceptable to him. Joshua, if you like, represents the whole of God's people, but he is patently unacceptable, verse 3. He is clothed in filthy garments. In fact, the translators of this particular Bible have spared our blushes. The word that's been used to translate filthy literally means that his garments were covered in excrement. He looks as if he's been living in a cesspit. Which I take it is why in this particular court case Satan has nothing to say. He doesn't need to open his mouth. No doubt he had arrived at court that morning with a whole file under his arm full of evidence against Joshua. Yet actually he doesn't need to open the file. He says nothing. Because as Joshua stands there in court, his filthy clothes say everything. Here is Joshua, the leader of God's people, but he is patently filthy, patently himself unfit to appear before God. And so he too is silent because there is nothing he can say in his defense. And in verse 4, if you just look on to the next sentence, it's clear, isn't it, that the filthy garments represent the iniquity, the wrongdoing of God's people. The fact that they were far from God. They had turned against God. They had no longer treated him as God, which is why in chapter 1, verse 3, God appeals to them to return to him. But I also want us to see that there is a sting in this courtroom scene. Because this courtroom scene here, in Zechariah chapter 3, anticipates another courtroom scene. Because it points forward to the future judgment day, the day on which each of us will have to stand before God, as Joshua the high priest had to stand before God here. Judgment day, the Bible tells us, is a certainty. Indeed, it tells us that the judgment day is the one thing that is left, if you like, in God's diary, in the rest of the history of the world. And the Bible leaves us in no doubt that we too are patently unfit to be in God's presence and are guilty before him. That however beautiful we look, however respectable we appear to one another, in God's sight, it is as if, like Joshua, we are clothed in filthy rags. Like God's people then, we've lived our lives with ourselves at the centre rather than with God at the centre. We may look very respectable, we may be quite religious, we may go to church, we may be none of those things. But nonetheless, in terms of the decisions and the priorities of everyday life, the things that fire our imaginations, the things which set us on fire, if you like, God fails to get a look in terms of the decisions and day-to-day facts of life. And whether or not we admit it to others, in our heart of hearts, we know God exists, we know there will be a judgment day, but we don't live like it. Now, as I've been thinking about this passage this week, it seems to me that one of the great problems which we have in thinking about this whole question of guilt is that so often we confuse false guilt, in other words, feeling guilty, with real guilt, in other words, actually being guilty. It's funny, isn't it? So often the things that worry us the most are actually the things which, in fact, are least important. Our consciences have a strange way, don't they, of distorting guilt. And so I can find myself not feeling at all guilty about things which I should feel guilty about, living for myself, not caring for others. It's so much of our culture, isn't it, to put ourselves at the centre and ignoring other people, and certainly ignoring God himself. But of course, there are other things which we do feel guilty about, which in fact we have no reason to feel guilty about at all. So I don't know if you have this experience, but whenever I walk through the Nothing to Declare channel at an airport. You obviously do have the same experience. I feel incredibly guilty. However much I say to myself, even kind of mentally go through the contents of my bags, that I have nothing to declare, as I push my trolley through, I feel as guilty as any drug courier. Well, I assume that I do. Anyway. So, you know, I don't know where to look. I mean, what do? I'm sort of holding my trolley. Do I look at the trolley? Do I look ahead of me, where I'm meant to be sort of heading at the other end? Do I smile at a customs officer? But then, of course, you might think I have something to declare. Or do I kind of eyeball them and not smile and try and look hard, but then, of course, they might not take a liking to me. You see, our consciences, you see, they are no guide, are they, to reality. Feeling guilty and being guilty are very different. And it may well be that we don't feel particularly guilty before God, in which case this is a great image in Zechariah chapter 3, because God tells us that, like Joshua, we are guilty, in fact, before him. Guilty, each one, of living in his world without reference to him, as if he was not God, not having him as God over us. And that's, just as we think about it, I just want us to ask the question honestly of ourselves. Do we see ourselves as God sees us, dressed in filthy rags, living without reference to him, and rightly deserving the Creator's condemnation on the judgment day? And you see, while it's easy to make excuses, I'm better than him, I'm not as bad as her, at least I haven't done such and such, can we see that that is not the issue? The fact that my filthy rags are slightly cleaner than someone else's filthy rags does not alter the fact that I am wearing filthy rags. Because, you see, the issue is our attitudes towards God. Have we turned to him? Do our lives acknowledge who he is? Or do we live as if he simply wasn't there? We all stand guilty before God. But can I say that once we have acknowledged our guilt, there is in fact enormous freedom in knowing exactly where we stand with God. You see, the Bible is wonderfully realistic. The Bible shows ourselves as we really are. That's not a pleasant sight, but actually much better to know the truth than to be misled. Because then we'll begin to see how wonderful it is that God says, "Return to me, and I shall return to you." So that is the first thing I want us to get a grasp on this evening. We are all guilty before God. But then secondly, on the outline, we may all stand forgiven in Jesus Christ. We may all stand forgiven in Jesus Christ. Because the shock of this courtroom scene is that Joshua does not get what he deserves. He is patently guilty, yet he is given new clothes as a picture that God has removed his wrongdoing. Just have a look, will you, at verses 4 and 5. And the angel said to those who were standing before him, "Remove the filthy garments from him." And to him he said, "Behold, I have taken your iniquity away from you, and I will clothe you with pure vestments." And I said, "Let them put a clean turban on his head." So they put a clean turban on his head and clothed him with garments, and the angel of the Lord was standing by. It's a wonderful picture of forgiveness, of being made fit to be in God's presence. Now, before we look at this in any more detail, I want us to see that God's treatment of Joshua appears to raise a question about God's justice. You see, I think it raises the question, what has happened to due legal process? Because here is Joshua, he is patently guilty, he is manifestly unfit to be in God's presence, yet suddenly he's forgiven. Is it that God has let him off the hook? If so, it raises a question of God's justice. I wonder if you saw those reports on, in the paper on Wednesday about how the day before the US forces entered Baghdad, Qusay Hussein, one of Saddam Hussein's sons, managed to drive off with $1 billion from the Baghdad Central Bank. I take it he didn't use his cash card, but he might have done. And the article went on to tell of the rule of terror which Qusay Hussein seemed to have inflicted on his country, how he's estimated to personally have killed 1,300 political opponents and have sanctioned the death of tens of thousands of others. And I was preparing this at the time. I was reading the paper so as not to have to work any more on this. And I thought to myself as I read the article, what will happen to him on the judgment day? And you see, as we look at Zechariah chapter 3, we're bound to think, well, someone like Qusay Hussein, will he simply be let off the hook on the judgment day? Is God unjust? Will he just say to him, don't worry, here's a new set of clothes? Well, we're going to see that God does not let the guilty off, but wonderfully, he does let those who will return to him, he does forgive them. And the explanation comes in verses 8 and 9. Have a look at verse 8. Hear now, O Joshua the high priest, you and your friends who sit before you, for they are men who are a sign. Behold, I'll bring my servant the branch. For behold, on the stone I set before Joshua, on a single stone with seven eyes, I'll engrave its inscription, declares the Lord of hosts. And I'll remove the iniquity of this land in a single day. Now we're told, if you look at it in verse 8, that Joshua is a sign. He's a sign of things to come. And we're told at the end of verse 9 that what has happened to him points forward to a future day when God will, in a single day, deal with the problem of sin and rebellion against him. In other words, he will do for the whole land, he will do for all his people what he has done for Joshua. He'll achieve it, verse 8, through his servant called the Branch, which is a slightly odd name. I don't know if any of you have that name, but it's in the Old Testament, it's a technical name for one who will be a descendant of King David, who was the greatest of Old Testament kings. Now, we don't have time to read through all of Zechariah, but Zechariah leaves us in no doubt that this branch is Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ was a descendant of King David, and that the day that's being referred to is the crucifixion. Just keep a finger in Zechariah chapter 3 and flick on a few pages to page 965. To Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 10, bottom right-hand corner. Zechariah 12 verse 10. And I'll pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and pleas for mercy, so that they will look on me, on him they have pierced. They shall mourn for him as one mourns for an only child. It's a verse that the New Testament picks up at the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, when the side of Jesus was speared by a Roman soldier to ensure that he was dead. It's even clearer, I think, that this is referring to Jesus just over the page in chapter 13, verse 1, which speaks again of this one day, this one coming day in history. Chapter 13, verse 1, on that day there shall be a fountain open for the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to cleanse them from sin and uncleanness. And therefore, you see, back in Zechariah chapter 3, what happens to Joshua is a wonderful visual aid for us of what the death of Jesus Christ achieved. We've been thinking about the death of Jesus Christ all evening, and this passage shows us very clearly, I think, what the death of Jesus achieved. He died, in short, so that we might be forgiven, so that like Joshua, on the judgment day, when we are in the dock, so to speak, we might stand before God forgiven rather than guilty. Just imagine if by whatever quirk of justice it took, Qusay Hussein ended up in court. The trial goes on for some time as all the atrocities that he has committed are read out in court. The case is reviewed. Many witnesses come forward to give their evidence. The evidence, it seems, is mountainous and irrefutable. And then finally, the great day arrives, the day of the judge's verdict. And of course, you can imagine the media, well, they're in a total frenzy. Not so much because the verdict is in any doubt. No, everyone is anticipating a guilty verdict. The issue is, what will the punishment be? What punishment will be sufficient to pay for his crimes? Well, then the judge speaks, and he says, I pronounce Qusay Hussein innocent, acquitted of all the crimes of which he has been accused. Well, can you imagine the uproar? Can you imagine the newspaper headlines, the tabloids screaming the next day? No doubt the judge would take a very long holiday after that one. You see, that is nothing compared with what God has done in Jesus Christ. If we think of Qusay Hussein as a guilty man, then what God sees in our hearts, what he sees in our lives, is far worse than what the human eye can see. He sees us living our lives independently of him, guilty before him. Yet Jesus Christ died that one day in history so that those who trust in him might be forgiven. Now that, if you like, is the negative side of what God has done in Jesus Christ. The taking off of filthy rags, to use the picture of Zechariah chapter 3, making it possible to be forgiven. But there's also another side, the positive side, verses 4 and 5, the giving of clean clothes. You see, it's a picture that when we put our trust in Jesus Christ, God credits to us, if you like, moral purity. He declares us to be fully right. He looks on us, clothed, if you like, in the clothes of Jesus Christ. God says to all those who return to him, from now on I'll treat you not as you deserve, but as my son, Jesus Christ. Just think again of Qusay Hussein. You see, it'd be like the judge saying to him, not just that he's not guilty, but in fact he had always lived a perfectly good and righteous life, that he had kept the law perfectly. Not only has he done nothing wrong, positively he has done everything right. Now that is what the death of Jesus Christ achieved. That is what God does for us when we put our trust in Jesus Christ. Our wrongdoing before God is removed, cancelled, but at the same time we are declared to be perfectly right in God's sight. Not only having done nothing wrong, but done everything right in God's sight. And therefore, you see, the wonderful truth is that if we do return to God, as God pleads us to, as he commands us to, and put our trust in Jesus Christ, we are then beyond the power of Satan's accusations. Because it means that on that judgment day, the Christian will stand before God, as all of us will have to, and will be declared forgiven. But more than that, will be declared always to have lived rightly, always to have pleased God. Now I want us to turn to one of the accounts of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. It's in Luke's Gospel on page 1065. Luke chapter 23. On page 1065. And I think we can see what the death of Jesus accomplished most clearly here. And I want us to focus on the two criminals who Luke told us were crucified at the same time as Jesus was. Have a look at Luke 23, verses 32 and 33. Two others who were criminals were led away to be put to death with Jesus. And when they came to the place that is called the Skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. Then drop down to verse 38. There was also an inscription over him this is the King of the Jews. One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." And he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And he said to him, "Truly, I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise." Now, I want us to see that here is a man who cannot earn his place in heaven. He cannot get down from the cross and earn it. He is about to die. For him, it is too late. He has patiently lived a bad life. To use the language of Zechariah, he is clearly filthy, a criminal being killed, executed by the state, and rightly so. Yet Jesus says to him, extraordinarily, "Today you will be with me in paradise." It's extraordinary because Jesus is claiming to be the one who determines whether or not someone goes to heaven, a prerogative, of course, that is God's alone. But you see, it is also a wonderful visual aid of all that the death of Jesus Christ achieved. Jesus died so that this man and many like him can stand before God forgiven, as if they have lived a perfect life. And still, God says to us today, return to me.